The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. It is 2018 and we are about 102 months deep into the second longest economic recovery in U.S. history and moving rapidly towards the 120-month record. 120 consecutive months of GDP growth is the record that happened during 1991 to 2001, according to my records, according to records posted through Wikipedia. And that decade-long economic expansion, again, from 91 to 2001, the average annual GDP growth was 2.1%, pretty much the same growth rate many economic observers today have basically wailed and gnashed their teeth over during this current economic recovery. Now, some of the operative questions, of course, are how long can this current recovery last? How fast can the U.S. economy grow without overheating? Remembering that we are, a $17 to $20 trillion economy. And what lies ahead for the U.S. real estate market in 2018 and perhaps beyond? Now, our guests, Melissa Reagan and Robert Bellinger, have signed up just to deal with that last question, the last of those three questions, which is really the forecast for real estate in 2018, although we might bleed over into the general economy just a bit. Melissa Reagan is head of research in the Americas for TH Real Estate. That's an affiliate of Nuveen, and Nuveen is the investment management arm of TIAA and one of the largest real estate investment managers in the world with about $107 billion of real estate assets under management. Robert Bellinger is president and CEO of ASB Real Estate Investments, a U.S. real estate investment management firm with about $7.4 billion in gross assets under management from more than 350 institutional clients. Melissa and Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Mike. It really is a pleasure to be here and looking forward to the next half hour or so with you.
And, you know, we're really happy to have you on board because here we are again, 2018, long recovery, a lot of people nervous, gateway markets priced to the hilt, nervousness about going into secondary markets. There is just, we may very well be at an inflection point right now, but we don't know. Nobody seems to have the powers of Nostradamus when it comes to real estate markets. But you happen to be a couple of people who pay an awful lot of attention to the fundamentals and can offer us some insights. So let's start just with kind of an overall picture of our situation, not getting into the specifics of property types or strategies. What is the real estate outlook for 2018 generally? And ladies first, Melissa Reagan, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So the 2018 outlook is really more of the same as it was in 2017. And by that, I mean supply and demand really kind of roughly in balance across the U.S. real estate market, as has been really throughout this entire cycle. And actually, real estate's been pretty much undersupplied throughout most of the cycle up until recently. So fundamentals look quite good. And then you could argue with me about multifamily being overbuilt and things like that. And we can talk about that later on. And then from, if you look at sort of just the lending perspective, so lenders have actually been very disciplined this cycle because they learned their lessons right from now 11 or 12 years ago. And by that, I mean, if you think about things like LTVs or debt service coverage ratios, actually look, you know, very healthy relative to what they were, 11 or 12 years ago. As well as just sort of a, just really a pullback in construction lending throughout this entire cycle, which has actually kept supply in check. So I would say in 2018, really more of the same. We expect fundamentals to look very solid, and that's largely due to supply and demand being in balance, as well as the really disciplined financing markets.
I would say that we are very hopeful about 2018, and our our view of the risk in real estate, which is largely driven by the risk in the macroeconomy, is one where we see this sort of distribution of risk as no longer being a normal distribution, and that the significant amount of outcomes are really concentrated closely around the mean. And then there's, I think, significant long tail risk, and by significant I mean probability is low, but if there's an occurrence, it could be pretty bad. And I think that the tail risk is created mostly by geopolitical instability and the international and domestic political risks that and uncertainty that all of us are feeling. On the economic front, it feels as though risks are much more moderate, which is why we feel that the sort of the outcomes are clustered around a sort of mean that's easier to understand, and will be driven by a stable economy. The final comment I'd make is that I think real estate has really benefited from this slow, somewhat choppy, but over the long term steady growth that we've experienced since early 2009. Everybody's complained about it, but it's given us discipline that we have never had before, I think, in my career, that's helped to tamp down building and speculation in real estate, and it's given this sort of slow, steady, I think, terrific fundamentals. And our concern would be this: what will the tax cut do? A very sort of late cycle stimulus from the federal government, which is very unusual. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty there because it's a corporate tax cut, not really a consumer tax cut. And it's tough to say what companies will do with the money and ultimately how stimulative that will be.
But let's talk then about property types. I'm curious, every year we tend to talk about what's going to be the star property type. It seems like industrial seems to pretty much win out every year. For a long time, apartments, although some people are suggesting that thread has run out. Melissa Reagan, what do you say? What's going to be the property type of the year? And just generally, what are the good property types going to be? Which ones would you tend to make sure you don't take too big a position in?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one of the sectors I'm really most bullish about is the retail sector, which is really out of favor by most investors because of the headlines, right? So everyone reads the headlines, retailers are filing bankruptcy, you know, deadmalls.com. It's a very negative story out there. But I'm actually quite positive on retail this year and even really through the remainder of the cycle and even into the next cycle for a couple of reasons. I think there is what's happening is actually really good. So a lot of the low-quality retail will get flushed out or certainly will become, and I don't know what that means, right? So people say, well, what does that mean? And be obsolete? Will it not exist? I'm not sure, but a lot of it will become flushed out and won't really be part of the institutional investment world anymore. And what you'll be left with is actually a really highly curated set of retail properties. And so by that, I mean consumer walks in to the shopping center, and it's really tailored to the demographic of that area. And you walk in, and it has the shops that you want. It has the restaurants you want, because the retailers, the restaurants, and the mall owners or the shopping center owners understand the demographic because they're harnessing all this data, and they're getting really sophisticated with these types of things. So that's really, I wouldn't say that's going to happen in 2018, but it's happening. I'm really most bullish about that sector.
Let me stop you a minute, mm-hmm. Melissa, because I just want to ask you, before you go on to any other property types, I'm curious, do you consider the United States over-retailed? Because it's been said for a long time the United States has way too much retail space. Are you expecting higher quality retail, but are you also expecting a thinning of retail space, total retail space?
Yeah, over-retailed, certainly if you take retail square feet per capita in the U.S. relative to other countries, we absolutely are over-retailed. I think you can make a lot of arguments that, yes, we're over-retailed, right? Think about, go to many of the suburbs across the U.S., and it's all kind of the same, you know, strip center that doesn't have really any sort of distinct offering. Why would you go there? Some of those actually do very well, but there's just many that, you know, just they offer nothing distinct. There's no reason why anyone would go. A lot of that stuff will, I think, get flushed out over time, and it will take a period of time for that to happen. So, yes, I do think we're over-retailed. I think it will get flushed out, and I think when we come out the other end of it,
it'll actually be a much better, healthier retail environment. So I guess the other question was property types that you're sort of less bullish on. Very hard to answer at such a macro level, right, because there's always, real estate's really asset-by-asset level investing. But, office is one of the sectors that we spend a lot of time looking at and getting, from a macro perspective, thinking about particularly at this point in the cycle, the amount of CapEx you need to put into an office property is quite high and higher than other property types. So being less comfortable with that, and also just sort of the amount of disruption that's happening within the office space. So everyone goes on and on about all the disruption happening in warehouse and retail, but what about office, right? And just sort of the amount of probably obsolescence that is there or will be coming as tenants want better space. They want, they want what a WeWork can offer, right? They don't want the old, 1980s drab office space anymore. So that's a sector we're just probably a little less bullish on. But certainly, asset by asset, it varies.
Bill, I think I'd segment the question into one relating to NOI and then one relating to the cap rate that gets applied to NOI. And on the NOI front, we're most bullish on logistics space that's close to urban centers. And I still think we're going through a very transformative period of figuring out how to get packages to people very quickly in a dense urban environment, and which today means same day. And we don't have the backbone for that really that exists today, and how that develops I think is going to be intriguing, and I think it'll be good for rental rates, particularly for industrial that is closer into urban centers. That doesn't mean it's downtown, right? But if it's 200 miles outside of the city, that's I think not what people want for obviously same day distribution. And I think that on the we feel that on the cap rate front, I would probably draft a little bit off of what Reagan said, which is that our view is that all of retail has been beaten down universally. And I think that probably unfairly so, that there are some areas of retail actually that are doing pretty well. Nobody's killing it, right? But some areas are doing pretty well and seeing NOI growth. Other areas are getting crushed. And if you can navigate that, there could be a buying opportunity to pick up retail properties that are going to perform well at better cap rates today and possibly do better than folks are thinking.
Let's talk about supply and demand a little bit. Are they in balance? One of the things everybody worries about when it comes to real estate is a hot sector getting overbuilt. And I think one of you alluded to earlier the idea that, this kind of slow economic recovery has served us well because we've been disciplined. The demand has not gone over the top, and I think lenders have also been quite scrupulous about their lending practices. Melissa, what do you say to that? Supply and demand in balance, or do you see some things going cattywampus?
As I said before, I think largely imbalanced. Now that really varies by market and by property type in each market. So certainly you've seen supply pick up across the warehouse sector, the CBD office sector in the last couple years. But I'd say still roughly imbalanced. That may change certainly for industrial, just given how how hot that sector's become, right? And investors just sort of really loving that sector, and more being built of industrial space. Multifamily certainly has seen, historically high, right, levels of apartment construction, and that has slowed down rent growth, right? So where you were seeing maybe 5 to 7% annual rent growth in the apartment sector, 3-4 years ago, you're seeing inflationary to slightly above inflationary rent growth, and even rents falling, quite frankly, for some really high-end luxury apartments in places like San Francisco, New York, and Miami. So there's been definitely pockets where you've seen a lot of supply.
I would say, on a broad level, that there's been a lot of new supply delivered in most every place where tenants really want to be, which makes sense, right? We feel usually demand will create supply, and that story is mostly urban. It's primarily in cities where young people want to live, and the new supply, while not, I think, overblown, has been significant, and what it's doing, in our opinion, is it's really flatlined rents. And if you look at the brokerage reports, they'll show you rent growth continues, for example, for office space in New York City. Rent growth continues for office space in Washington, D.C. And I think the more nuanced story is the statistics that they're providing are asking rents, generally, because the data is not very good, robust, for effective rents, because nobody publishes those numbers, right? That's more anecdotal. But if you look through the effective rents, I think the real story is that many of these markets' rents, frankly, are flat. And that's okay, because the supply will get absorbed, and then we'll be able to get back to having a little more pricing power and pushing rent. In markets where the tenants have been, you know, showing less interest, and there's been limited construction, which you can look at a number of suburbs and see that phenomenon, or some secondary and tertiary markets where capital's been reluctant also to invest in development, rents are growing on an effective basis. So I think it's a mixed bag, but our view is that development is having a significant impact, particularly in major markets. And the long-term news, it's great in that these markets are becoming even more vibrant, exciting, offering even better products to tenants. But we're going through a bit of a transition period as the space gets absorbed.
So as we look to 2018 in the real estate category, what's the better strategy, debt or equity? Now, obviously, both are going to be in a portfolio, but if you're rebalancing that portfolio and the real estate investment dollars are going to be divided between equity and debt, which direction is it going to be trending for most portfolios, do you think?
You know, at this point in the cycle, you're thinking about allocating between real estate equity versus commercial mortgages. And by this point in the cycle, I mean, you know, I don't know if we're at the peak, but we're somewhere, certainly we're in the mature phase, right, call it. You know, mortgages at this point are probably going to give you a better risk-adjusted return. That doesn't mean go and allocate your entire portfolio to mortgages. It does mean that on the margin, to sort of just, you know, protect your portfolio, you'd want to allocate to mortgages. And so by risk-adjusted, I really mean if you think about sort of your outlook for total return for real estate equity investments, you know, in the next couple of years, it's probably, you know, 5-6% total return, maybe lower depending on what your view is of real estate markets. And then if you think about a mortgage, and kind of depending on what risk level you're going to take on in a mortgage, you know, you're close to that, but with less volatility. And so you do get a better risk-adjusted return, at least at this point in the cycle, for allocating to mortgages.
You concur, Robert?
Here's our view on debt. I do think it's a complex question, because the industry has offered a much broader array of products that blend between debt and equity, particularly by applying leverage to debt that would otherwise be low risk and creating a higher return out of it and making it more risky. Whether that's mezz debt or taking traditional first mortgage loans and levering them up with portfolio debt. Either way, you're taking a fairly conservative, right, debt and making it more risky through financial engineering. And that does worry me. And look, I think a lot of folks feel that interest rates have greater risk of going up. We've all been talking about it for a long time, but in 2017, they finally did go up. The Fed has openly communicated that they're expecting 3 rate increases in this year in 18, but with this stimulus, who knows where that goes? And investing in fixed-rate debt in a rising interest rate environment may not be a great bet. I would say that we've seen a lot of interest from institutional investors for debt products. Clearly, for life insurance companies, mortgages make a lot of sense because they're matching those assets with similar term liabilities. But for investors that are return-driven, in an environment where there appears to be more inflation risk, it seems to us that equity makes a lot more sense. And if you want to reduce your risk, then core real estate is a good way to do that. Rather than trying to reduce risk, but still stretching for return by going into a hybrid debt product that has built-in leverage, but ultimately has limited upside because it's a debt product and greater sensitivity to inflation and interest rates, where in equity real estate, I think you have hopefully some inflation protection, particularly on the core side.
So demography always plays a big role in the real estate business. What favorable and unfavorable demographic trends are expected to fuel or hinder the real estate industry's performance during this year?
I'd say, you know, one of the more favorable trends is really the aging baby boomers. And by that, I really mean, you know, certainly favorable for things like medical office and senior housing, just as they start to age. And that takes place, they definitely will need senior housing kind of going forward. So that's definitely a favorable trend. A lot of the millennial trend remains favorable at least for another couple years. Probably 5 to 7 years. And then after that, you do get a bit of a drop-off if you move to sort of Generation Z, but not such a drop-off that you're sort of, you know, really concerned. But at least for 2018, I would say most of the demographic trends remain pretty favorable, and any headwinds are actually, you know, probably 5 to 7 years out at this point.
Our view is that demographics are a concern, right, if you sort of look through the rearview mirror, because we are appear to be close to full employment, and real estate returns are not going to be great. There will be no sizzle. They might be okay, but without strong job growth, it's tough to see a lot of upside in real estate. Clearly, we need jobs to create demand for real estate that gives you pricing power. And at close to full employment, where are those jobs going to come from? And the other worry, right, is that we are being very tight in our country and many developed economies with respect to immigration policies. And there's a lot of, you know, new populism that's, I think, dampening political interest in opening up immigration, which will hurt job growth in America. Clearly, job growth, as the birth rate has steadily declined in America, immigration has been critical to our long-term GDP growth, population growth, and real estate returns. Where's that going to come from? And I would say that maybe the sort of the hope is going to come from the baby boomers, which is, again, if you look through the rearview mirror, you'd say, well, they're going to start retiring, as you know Reagan started to talk about. But most of the baby boomers in America, it looks like they're broke. They've not been saving. Many of them no longer have a pension plan. They have a 401k plan that doesn't have enough money in it. And they're going to have to keep working. And that could be the new paradigm, which is that people are not just aging in place, right? They're working while they're aging. And that would be good, frankly, for real estate and for our ability to maintain and increase employment, because if on one side of the funnel you aren't losing jobs, and then you continue to create jobs, albeit very slowly, I think that would be good for long term, medium term for demographics in America, and we think that's a likely outcome.
Yeah, it's pretty scary the lack of resources aging baby boomers have for retirement. That's been highlighted quite a bit and definitely cause for concern. Melissa, your organization says that investor appetite for alternative real estate sectors have been growing for years. Tell us, why is that, and what is considered alternative real estate sectors?
Alternatives is probably not a correct way to call these property types anymore, because the institutional investors have gain so much exposure to them, but certainly not as much as the core property types. So when you think about alternatives, you think self-storage, student housing, senior housing, medical office, anything that really that isn't really part of the four, right? So office, industrial, apartments, and retail. And so people call anything that sits outside of those four alternatives, and that may or may not be the correct terminology depending on how much exposure you have to what we say alternatives. And so, you know, I think investors have increased their appetite for alternatives just as probably a portfolio diversifier and saying, I'd actually like exposure to some of these demographically driven sectors rather than job growth driven sectors where you in large, you can say, you know, a lot of the four core property types are really more driven by job growth, where some of the alternatives are not as highly driven by job growth. So if you think about student housing, that's really more driven by demand for going to college, right? Senior housing, really driven by baby boomers retiring and needing that kind of housing. self-storage, also you could talk about being more demographically driven. So those are the types of things I think investors want, that kind of diversification. And it isn't that they're providing you with such a astronomically higher return than the four core property types. They're really not. Maybe they were, you know, 15 years ago, but they're not today. But it's really more of a diversification play.
So Robert Bellinger, your firm is focused on urban U.S. markets and commercial real estate, specifically. What cities have been leading the pack for investors during this, what is now, a 10-year recovery?
I think the dominant theme of the last 10 years has been a really systemic change in how, across America, how people want to live. And it's led to a true reurbanization of our country. And I don't care what market you're in, people are yearning for a more urban, vibrant, exciting place to live and work and have fun. They want to have connections with folks. And I think that's true whether you're a young professional or a baby boomer or an empty nester. And it's been happening in major markets, secondary markets, tertiary markets. And I think that's been the headline story. And frankly, based on what we're seeing, will continue to be. Clearly, there are challenges right now around affordability that are having an impact. But to directly answer your question, probably the three strongest markets in terms of performance over the last 10 years have been New York City, San Francisco, and Boston. And even in San Francisco, where the technology epicenter clearly was out in Silicon Valley, dominant companies like Google are opening offices in downtown San Francisco because many employees that are dying to be there, and they don't want to lose out to companies like Salesforce, who are headquartered in downtown San Francisco.
So let's take that to the future now. And Robert, you lead off on this one. And name a few North American cities that you expect to sizzle in 2018. Now, you already said 2018 is not going to sizzle, but obviously there's always the outliers. What few cities would you point to and say 2018, they're going to be accelerating. They're going to be leading the pack.
Well, I certainly do feel that, unfortunately, the beef is looking very lean right now, and there's just not a lot of sizzle left. But that doesn't mean it's not a great time, right, to earn what should be, I think, on a risk-adjusted basis, a terrific return. And our feeling is that we've gone through this period in the cycle. We're late in the cycle where risk premiums have significantly narrowed, and whether that's the risk premium between a primary market like Boston and a secondary or tertiary market like Nashville, where cap rates have compressed and come closer together, or risk spreads have narrowed between a Class A asset and a troubled Class B minus asset that's 60% leased. I think yields have compressed for all of that, and so where's the sizzle on that? I think it's going to all be driven by rent growth, right? So cap rate compression seems to be largely done, and where can you find rent growth over the next year? And I think that folks are going to find that that's generally going to be where there hasn't been a lot of building, a lot of new construction. That said, then you need to think about where you want to be through the next downturn. And if you get out a little too much over your skis by trying to find yield, right, and stretching for where you're seeing short-term rent growth, that may not be a long-term strategy that works. And our feeling is, rather than looking for the sizzle in 2018, investors should have a longer term view of thinking about a cycle durable investing that gets us through whenever the next downturn occurs. And we're not predicting that's happening this year, but it's clearly going to happen at some point. And it feels like that point is closer today than it was to us yesterday.
You know, long-term thinking is always great, but we also like immediate gratification, Melissa Reagan. So where's it going to snap, crackle, pop city-wise in 2018? Does Robert have any blind spots here that you would point to?
No, I largely agree. And sort of thinking about, I don't think there'll be any sizzle much in 2018. As I said, probably total returns will probably be 5-6%, which is fine, but it's not certainly stellar. But sort of thinking about some interesting cities, on the top of our radar, a place like Orlando, which is, really more of a growth target for us, not really a core target. Some interesting stuff happening in that market with the University of Central Florida really trying to position themselves as becoming an incubator for aerospace defense and really trying to become really the hub of aerospace defense in the U.S. And positioning itself to do that and really having what they call an innovation week where they get all the major aerospace defense contractors to come in and to think about, where is this industry going? How are we going to innovate? So it's very interesting. We look for more things, really kind of bottom-up things like that that, listen, that may or may not materialize for Orlando, but it is something to certainly keep our eyes on. Things like Pittsburgh, right, and what's happening with the fact that Uber, had their first self-driving car in Pittsburgh, and Google's there, and Uber's there, and, some emerging tech companies are in Pittsburgh. And that was true, two or three years ago, but it's sort of those are kind of really bottom-up things that we look for in terms of thinking about a city not just for 2018, but also a city that will look really good long term. Because if these things take off in Orlando or Pittsburgh, that'll actually be a city you want to bet on for the long term. And we still like the coastal cities and things like that. But by and large, trying to find any value there is more and more difficult, at least from a core perspective.
So we're only about 18 months short of meeting or beating the longest economic recovery in U.S. history. Obviously, real estate's been very good. When is the downturn going to come? Melissa, what do you say in terms of when you expect a correction? Maybe that's not a question you can really answer, but why don't you dance your way around that one if you can't answer it?
Great. Okay. I will do that. I always say the cycle, probably has a couple more years left in it. And so I dance around it by saying a couple, right? You can leave that up to whatever you want it to be. But I really do think, certainly we're in the mature phase. If we're not at the top, we're close to it. That doesn't mean that just because you're at the top, you have to fall off a cliff tomorrow. And so you can have a couple more years left. And I get comfortable making that statement just because, I do think there is a lot more discipline in this real estate cycle than there was last time, from a lender perspective, as well as from a supply perspective. And fundamentals don't, you know, still look solid. They're not stellar, but they're solid. And certainly lending is more disciplined this time around than it was last time around. So that gives me comfort in that couple-year statement that I make.
Well, Melissa went out on a limb just a little bit. Robert, what do you think about that two-year time frame? Longer, shorter?
Well, let me put it this way. I think you said we've got 18 months to hit a new record. America loves breaking records, right? A relative of my son's gave him a Fitbit this year for the holidays. And yesterday, he proudly announced, after walking around the kitchen island about 100 times, that he'd broken his step record and hit 20,100 steps. And I think that we should go for the record, and I think we'll get there. I just don't feel that. I think our view is that today it doesn't feel like there's a lot of excess out there that's going to push us into a recession, and that we have a fairly savvy Fed that's not going to tighten too quickly and push us over the edge. And so it's probably going to come from something none of us expect, right? An exogenous big event that shocks us and sends everybody flying and throwing away risk and turning the risk off. And so obviously that's completely unpredictable when that event occurs. But if we can continue as we have been in terms of not seeing one of those catastrophic sort of global meltdown events, exogenous events, it feels like fundamentals could continue for certainly 2-3 years or even longer. And I say, let's go break that record and have the longest recovery that we've ever had in our country. We think we'll get there.
A lot of people are on board with you on that. One last question quickly. Exogenous events aside, Robert, if there's any red flag you see waving right now, what would that be?
You know, often as human beings, our greatest strengths can also be the source of our greatest weaknesses. I think the economy is maybe not too different. And one of the greatest strengths of our economy over this whole cycle has been this technology sector. And from our view of what's happening in tech, we feel that it feels a little frothy, but still a lot of great fundamentals in technology. But if there were to be a significant pullback a la 2000, you know, in technology, I think that would be very hard. That could be an event that pulls us into a recession just like it did in 2000, maybe even worse this time, because we are just feels like we're so dependent in terms of economic growth, job growth, fill up real estate on the creative and technology sectors.
Mm. Melissa Reagan, what say you on red flags?
I would say certainly. I'm not overly concerned about the tech sector. I actually kind of think the correction already happened, frankly, maybe a year and a half ago. Just a lot of it was not in the public markets, so it was all held in venture capital or private equity, and it wasn't transparent, but there certainly have been a lot of revaluations of privately held tech companies. I think that already happened, honestly. And so I'm not so concerned about that. I am concerned certainly about what does end this all. And you said don't talk about anything exogenous, but I do agree it'll be something exogenous. My only real other concern is as the cycle continues, and if it lasts 2 or 3 more years, just the fundamentals maybe do get a little wacky with supply really outstripping demand. That would probably be my biggest concern at this point. I don't get concerned about lending. You know, regulations have been really strong and strict since the financial crisis, for good reason. So don't worry about that. But just something that happens in the fundamental side if this cycle continues to last a couple more years.
Robert, I know you need to sign off, but just quickly, exogenous event. Would you venture to say what type of exogenous event you think might come to pass?
North Korea, right?
Okay,
something in North Korea would be terrible. clearly. If whether it's a nuclear event or not, war in the Korean Peninsula would I think melt everybody down. So I think that is a possibility. We hope and pray that it's a super low possibility, right? I have just no idea how to weight that, but it could be geopolitical, right? As opposed to economic.
I see. And how about you, Melissa? Any exogenous event that particularly worries you? An asteroid strike? I'm kidding about that, but.
I tend to agree. Certainly North Korea. Just the political landscape in general in the U.S. and rather the instability around that, and just people being not happy with sort of either Republican or Democrat, and just sort of where that all leads us, frankly. I think about that quite a bit. That would probably be my biggest concern, actually far before North Korea. Just where does all of the political angst actually lead us in a few years from now?
Okay, our guests have been Melissa Reagan and Robert Bellinger. Melissa Reagan is head of research for the Americas at TH Real Estate, and Robert Bellinger is president and CEO of ASB Real Estate Investments. Robert, Melissa, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mike.